That's music from the independent film Beasts of the Southern Wild, a sensation at Sundance and in theaters this summer. New York Times critic A.O. Scott called Beasts of the Southern Wild an astonishing work of magic realism. Other critics have called the film fresh and powerful, like almost nothing movie lovers have seen before. We'll talk about Beasts in the hour ahead as we take a look at the summer movies with filmmaker Christopher Llewellyn Reed and midday interns Galen Druk and Stephanie Hom. Brave, Ted, Moonrise Kingdom, Magic Mike, and Woody Allen's latest, To Roam with Love. Midday on Film, the summer movies, after the news. Welcome back to Midday. So more of that music. Let's listen to a little bit of this. This is from this most talked about independent film, Beasts of the Southern Wild. We really like this. Beasts of the Southern Wild, which was a sensation at Sundance this past winter, tells the story of a six-year-old girl named Hush Puppy who lives an impoverished life along the southernmost fringes of Louisiana. The film has received praise for its powerful message of resilience and its atmospheric qualities, and for the performance, especially that of the little girl in the lead role. We're going to talk about Beasts of the Southern Wild, and we would like to hear from our listeners who might have seen it. This is Midday on Film, a look at the summer movies. Joining me in the studio today to do this is filmmaker Christopher Llewellyn Reed, chair and associate professor of film and video at Stevenson University. Christopher Llewellyn Reed blogs about movies and writes movie reviews on his website, and I think we already posted that to our Facebook page, chrisreed.stevensonuniversity.org. And Chris Reed back with us after visiting here briefly last week. Nice to see you again, Chris.
Nice to be here. Thanks, Dan.
Thank you. Thank you very much for joining us. Also, we invited to take part in this hour to talk about the summer movies, Galen Druk and Stephanie Hahn. Galen and Stephanie have been serving as midday interns here during the spring and summer. Galen graduated from Johns Hopkins University in May, and Stephanie Hom is a sophomore at Johns Hopkins. So it's nice to have you guys actually in the studio with me doing the show. So, Galen, how you doing?
I'm great. I'm very excited.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you, Stephanie, for going out and seeing these movies on our behalf. And we thought, Chris, we thought we'd get their perspectives on these too. So anyway, thanks for being here. I want to start with Beasts of the Southern Wild because we've been hearing so much about it ever since Sundance, and it came into the Baltimore market, Galen, in the last couple of weeks, we think, right?
Yeah.
In the last month or so, and I see it's still opening in various cities around the country, and I've read some sort of astonishing reviews by some veteran critics around the country, one who said that you may not have ever seen a film quite like this before. So I'd like to start with Chris Reed on this, if you don't mind, just your impressions of Beasts of the Southern Wild.
Well, I found it a really worthy effort, and not only did it do really well at Sundance, it also took the Camera d'Or prize at Cannes, which is the award given to Best First Feature. And I think the film has a lot of really remarkable qualities. Beautiful cinematography, that music we were just hearing, the great performance by the young girl whose name is something like Kavanjane Wallace, playing Hush Puppy. I really like the unique voice that we hear in a really kind of well-crafted voiceover. And I really especially like the fact that this is a movie shot on film. It's shot on Super 16mm film as opposed to kind of, you know, high-resolution digital formats. And it really, therefore, has this kind of tactile quality that we don't get to see a lot these days, particularly in the summer months when we're seeing, you know, big-budget IMAX 3D movies. All of that.
Can I stop you on that and ask you about that? I read that the film captures nature in a way, makes nature gives nature a feel, and it creates this atmosphere. Is that part of the reason because of because film was used? What do you think of that?
I'm not so sure that nature comes through because it was shot on film. I mean, a recent film, Winter's Bone, which was shot on a red camera, also had this wonderful quality of photographing nature. I think that's probably more. because the cinematographer was, you know, so interested in photographing nature, reminded me of some Terrence Malick films in that way.
That's what I just read here. This was from, I read so many reviews here. One is from Hollywood Reporter Chris, referring to Ben Zeitlin.
That's the name of the director, yes.
Director. The first few minutes alone established Zeitlin as some kind of heir to Terrence Malick in the way he makes nature register on screen.
Yeah.
So it isn't so much the film that's doing that, it's the director.
The director and the director of photography, who've clearly decided to focus, you know, their lens on these wonderful cutaways to nature, which in this case isn't always beautiful per se, because some of it's rotting. But the way that they show it, you really feel like you haven't seen the world in quite this way before. Now, all of that said, when the film ended, I found myself perhaps not quite as rhapsodic as some other film critics had been. And so I began to ask myself why. And ultimately, I felt like the film didn't quite justify its formlessness for me.
Formlessness.
Right.
Almost like a, would you say, a documentary style in some ways?
Well, I felt like it needed to go, for me, kind of either more in one direction or the other, sort of kind of maybe be even more dreamy than it was, or maybe, you know, be slightly more story-centric. For me, I didn't feel like it got the mix quite right to be my favorite film of the summer, but I thought it was a very worthy movie.
Well, Gayle Droog, I want to go to you on this because I wonder what your impressions of Beast of the Southern Wild was as you were sitting there and this film enveloped you.
Absolutely. So I had a similar feeling to the critic you read, actually, as the credits rolled. I felt like it was something I'd never seen before in my life. And I think part of that actually may come from the plot ambiguity. You know, you don't really know, even during the film, you're not sure exactly what's happening. It's sort of part of this sort of magical, you know, mysterious, prehistoric, you know, creature theme. But at the same time, you're not sure, like, if it's just a machination of her mind and if she understands sort of like her fleeting existence to be paralleled with those prehistoric creatures.
So is Hush Puppy throughout, is she narrating? Do you hear Hush Puppy's voice as she moves along through this odyssey?
Yeah, and what I thought was particularly unique about this film is really it's a voice we haven't heard before, because he's a six-year-old girl who's thinking really, really quite mature thoughts, bringing in these kind of, you know, prehistoric links. Another, of course, parallel with Terrence Malick, since his most recent film, Tree of Life, also brought in a little bit of prehistory.
Is this her fantasy?
It's her fantasy, but it's also kind of, I think, bringing us into her desire to escape from this bathtub world with her father, who's dying, and you know, a life that may not be headed someplace positive. And we enter into her mindset in a way that we actually don't frequently hear, because so often voiceover is used to just tell us the story that we're already seeing. And in this film, we get it in this kind of really kind of unique commentary on what she's experiencing, as opposed to telling us.
And when you say bathtub is actually a reference to the place where
that's
she lives.
That's the location,
right?
Yes. The location is called the bathtub.
Right. Now, do you get the feeling as she's going through these experiences and you hear her voice and she's having these fantasies, right, that the world is ending? The world is ending around her? Is that what's happening, without giving away too much more?
I think that's a take on it. I think that, you know, sort of part of what he discussed in the there's no clear direction of the film, you can sort of take from it what you will. There is an element of climate change and rising sea level and sort of the potential doom of the bathtub. But at the same time, she's very at home in the bathtub. And actually, when she is evacuated at one point, her description of the sort of modern world outside of the bathtub, actually, I found that I had never myself felt so uncomfortable with modern life. Her description was somewhat like it was a fish tank with no water in it. And she's in this sterile hospital setting. And you really feel like even if sort of the bathtub that she knows is in peril, she is very much a part of it. And, you know, she's still at home in the bathtub.
They were speaking here of the six-year-old girl, Quvenzhané Wallace, who plays the role of Hush Puppy in Beasts of the Southern Wild. If you've had a chance to see that film, it went into wide release earlier this month and is still opening in some cities. Please give us a ring during this hour of Midday on Film. We're talking about the summer movies, 410 662-8780. Toll-free long distance, 866-661-9309. Please send comments about your favorite film of the summer, or maybe the worst film of the summer, midday@wypr.org. We're joined by Christopher Llewellyn Reed of Stevenson University, a filmmaker who also teaches film there, and our midday interns, Galen Druk and Stephanie Hahn. We'll hear from Stephanie when we come back as we take this break and listen to some more of that music from Beasts of the Southern Wild. This is Midday on Film. When we get back, other films of the summer, some of the... It's a little film, Beasts of the Southern Wild. We'll get to go to the big stuff after this short break. Yeah, more music there from Beasts of the Southern Wild, which is playing at the Charles, right? Mm-hmm. Dan Roderick's here. Christopher Llewellyn Reed joining us in this hour to review the summer movies along with midday interns Galen Druk and Stephanie Hahn and Beth in Towson, because our listeners can join in these reviews too. 410-662-8780. Beth, you got to see Beasts of the Southern Wild?
I did, and I really, really wanted to like it. And I think the acting and writing was amazing. But I have a bit of a different take on it, which is that the camera work was so jerky that I physically got ill. I had to watch most of the movie with my eyes closed and just listen.
Wow.
So this seems to happen a lot in more recent movies. I think it's artsy and edgy and that kind of thing, but I physically can't watch it. I wanted to like it more than I did.
Yeah, I've seen that too, and I've had that reaction at times, but, you know, I paid my $8.50, so I go along with it and try not to take some Dramamine, maybe. But, I mean, how bad was that, Chris or Galen? Do you want to talk about that?
Beth, first of all, I'm sorry that it did make you somewhat ill watching it. Certainly, I have known people who've watched other films shot this way who felt the same way. For me, though, that was part of the appeal. Even though there were some things I might not have liked ultimately about the film, the way it was shot was really, for me, one of the most amazing parts of the movie, and was definitely, I think, intentional choice by shooting in it that way. I think they made it feel very documentary-like, so that we really felt as if we were watching real people, which for the most part we were, since the film is largely populated with non-actors. And I think that style, coupled with the Super 16mm format, really kind of plunges us into this world that feels more real because of it.
You mentioned that these are non-actors, right?
For the most part,
this little girl, this is her start. And the man who plays her father in this,
he's
also
a baker, I believe.
He's a baker?
Yeah.
Right. Well, let's go to back to the early part of the summer, I guess, when summer began. The Avengers was in there somewhere, right? I think that marked the beginning of the summer movie season. Did anyone get to see The Avengers?
I did, actually.
What did you think of that film?
I loved it. I'm a huge superhero fan. I love Marvel, and I've seen the Iron Man and Captain America and Thor. And I think it was just, for people who really love superheroes, it's a great action-packed movie. And it really brings together a huge, amazing cast. And really, I don't think any of them overshadow anyone.
Hmm.
And really, Joss Whedon does a great job in storytelling.
Samuel L. Jackson didn't take over? No?
No, he was only a small part of the movie.
Okay, Robert Downey Jr. is in that, Chris Evans. Chris Reed, you got to see The Avengers?
Yeah, and I enjoyed it a lot more than I thought I would. I had some reservations because I hadn't liked the Thor movie, although I had liked all the other Marvel films. But I ended up really enjoying the film, and I thought the 3D technology was used brilliantly. I thought Mark Ruffalo, who jumped in after not having played Hulk in the previous films, did a great job. My only problem sometimes with these ensemble films is I feel as if we never get to enjoy any one person's story enough, and that can sometimes kick me out of the film. But, you know, if you're looking for a big-budget summer movie with a lot of great actors doing, you know, having a great time playing these parts, I think it's a really fun film to watch.
Now, that came out in May, so here we are, late July. Is it still around? Does anyone know? Have you seen it?
Oh, yeah. It's still playing.
They keep that around. And, of course, Amazing Spider-Man came out this year. Now, this summer... Now, this is one of these franchise films, right? The last one we had was Spider-Man 3, if I'm not correct, right? So this is The Amazing Spider-Man. What's going on here? Who's in it that would be different? In what way would it be different, Stephanie?
Well, it's a completely new reboot. They took out Tobey Maguire, Kirsten Dunst, the original cast.
Okay, so they're not in it.
No, they're not.
Okay.
It's now Andrew Garfield. He was in The Social Network. And Emma Stone. And I don't know. I went in thinking it wasn't going to be as good because I thought the previous Spider-Man movies were already pretty well done.
Mm-hmm.
But I think Andrew Garfield's take on Peter Parker was definitely new, and it was something exciting to see because it's very similar to how Peter Parker was actually portrayed in the comic books, and I think he did a great job, and the chemistry between him and Emma Stone was just excellent.
Okay. Chris Reed?
I couldn't agree more. This surprised me. I when I heard they were making the film, I asked why. The first three Spider-Man films were fine. Thought Tobey Maguire did a good job. And then I saw this movie, and I think the script was smart. Andrew Garfield did a great job as Spider-Man. He's a wisecracking superhero, just like he is in the comic books. And finally, the science, and I know we often don't go to films like this for the science, but they actually did something just like in the comic books, different from the original Tobey Maguire films, where instead of the web coming out of his wrist, which was a really silly choice in the original Spider-Man film, they went back to him as a science student, kind of making his own bracelet that had web fluid in it. And I thought that was a nice touch, because even if you can buy the fact that somebody is turned into a human with superpowers such as a spider, there's no way his body could actually produce that much web to go slinging through the city. So it was just a little touch that really impressed me.
Something different, right?
Yeah.
In a different cast. So the way to revive a franchise that's suffering some fatigue, is this the formula?
Possibly.
Change the cast?
Although I hope we don't start seeing reboots of every film that was made just 10 years ago. But if you're going to do it, do it this way.
Well, we have a clip from this. Peter Parker, as Stephanie Hom said, played by Andrew Garfield, goes to visit Captain Stacy. This is Dennis Leary, right? I like to see Dennis Leary getting movie roles. Now, and he's also the dad of Emma Stone in the film?
Yes.
Peter Parker's love interest? Okay, so in this scene, Peter tries to tell Captain Stacy, Dennis Leary, that the identity of the man behind the lizard attacks, okay? Does that make sense to you guys who have seen the film?
Yes, it does.
Okay, and the first voice you'll hear is that of Dennis Leary.
Mr. Parker, why are you not in school?
Got a free track.
Okay, well, I do not have a free track, so make your point quickly.
Okay, fine, there may not be a dinosaur running around Manhattan, but there is something more dangerous, and I know who it is.
You know who it is?
Dr. Curtis Connors?
Of Oscorp?
That's right.
Dr. Curtis Connors, who's also my daughter's mentor. Is that who you're talking about?
That's the one.
You know, recently Dr. Connors gave Gwen a glowing college recommendation. It was beautiful. When I read it, I cried. But you would have me believe that he, in his spare time, is running around dressed up like a giant dinosaur.
Not dressing up and not a dinosaur. He has transformed himself into a giant lizard.
Let me ask you a question. Do I look like the mayor of Tokyo?
Do I look like the mayor of Tokyo? Is that what he said?
Yes.
That is what he says, yeah. And he's great in this movie. Dennis Leary is one of the charms of the film.
Mm-hmm. Another film from the summer that we want to talk about. Let's see. Which list are we going by here? Are we going by our clip list or our segment list? Which one are we going by here? Should we go to Brave? All right, let's go to Brave next. Now, this is a Disney Pixar film. Chris and Stephanie have seen it, so I'll start with Stephanie on this. Brave, tell us about this film.
Well, it's the first time Pixar put a female lead in the movie, and I think for the most part it was a beautifully done movie, but I think the plot and the storyline could have been a little bit better. They could have done a little bit more with the mother-daughter relationship that they planned on doing, but it's great for families to bring their kids to. It's a nice summer movie.
This stars Kelly MacDonald, Emma Thompson's in it, and Craig Ferguson. And this came out in June. Chris, are you a Pixar fan?
I am a huge Pixar fan, and I enjoyed this film, but I did not enjoy it as much as some earlier Pixar films. I tend to agree with Stephanie's review. I think it's beautifully animated. If you're looking for a good family film to go to this summer, go to see this. But it ended up feeling more like a traditional Disney princess movie where the usual things happen to the usual
kind
of princess.
Talking about a franchise.
Exactly. Right. As opposed to having that wonderful, unique voice that we've come to expect from movies like WALL-E, Up, Monsters, Inc., and so I felt like it was much more, it felt like a Disney film rather than a Pixar film.
Okay, but is Disney Pixar a deal, right? But so Stephanie's making an interesting point here. The earlier Pixar films, the leads were male or robotic or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? Okay. So this is sort of more in the line of, as Chris was saying, those films that we saw back in the 90s and later, Mulan, Pocahontas. What else?
Little Princess.
Oh, Little Princess, Little Mermaid, all
Beauty
of those.
Beauty and the Beast.
Right, yeah. Right. And I noticed in almost all of those, if not all of those, the female lead, the heroine lead, has no mother. Did you ever notice that? I did. I think they are, the mom is missing, the father's there, and the father is sort of a, not always a bumbling fool, but he doesn't get it right, and the daughter wins the day.
Mm-hmm.
So does that kind of happen with Brave as well? Or are there parents around hovering about? That's what my question is about the lead character, Merida.
Well, definitely Merida.
Merida, sorry.
Merida. And her mother, Eleanor.
Yeah.
She definitely plays a very active role in her life. I think the difference between Merida and other like Disney princesses is the fact that she's more gritty and more tomboyish. She doesn't like to pretty herself up. She wants to ride her pony and shoot arrows.
Great. Okay. I have a question for Chris about Pixar. You say animation, right? And I guess maybe this is generational. I don't know. I still think of animation as something involving the artist's hand actually moving and drawing cartoons, animating film. Pixar, though, are people drawn to Pixar because of the technology, the quality of the film visually, or because of these great stories they come up with?
I think the reason Pixar has been such a huge success is because of the scripts and the stories. I think the animation is secondary. I think they're a wonderful animation company, and of course, we know that they were not founded but shepherded by Steve Jobs in the 90s, and definitely he was interested in the technology that produced the movies. But I think what makes Pixar truly unique are their wonderful stories.
You're listening to Midday on Film. Christopher Llewellyn Reed, along with our interns here at Midday, Galen Druk and Stephanie Hom, as we take a look at the summer movies. You're free to call in and tell us about your favorite summer movie so far, or your least favorite, or the one that disappointed you. 410-662-8780 is our number, our toll-free number, 866-661-9309, and the Midday email address is midday@wypr.org. So there's another Men in Black film?
Yes.
Is Will Smith in this one?
He is.
Oh, help me out. What did you think of this film? Tell us about it.
I liked it. It's better than the second one. A lot of people had the problems with the second Men in Black film. But this one, it was 10 years after they released the second one. And I think what made this movie so enjoyable was Josh Brolin's take on Tommy Lee Jones' character. I thought he was spot on. It was great to see him playing someone else who was also in the movie. And it was just, it's fun and it's enjoyable. And the 3D wasn't as bad as you would think it would be.
Oh, it wasn't as bad as you think it would be?
Yeah.
Oh, this is 3D.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, so you have to watch it with glasses,
you
huh?
You do, yeah.
What do you mean it wasn't as bad as you thought it would be?
Well, I'm not a huge fan of 3D, and I think that some movies that it's not necessary for it to be shot in 3D, especially if it's not specially designed for
right.
it. But really, they had some great shots where if you didn't have the 3D glasses, it kind of, you can't see that depth of the shot.
Oh, let me go to Chris Reed on this one, Chris, because I'm curious about the replacement for Tommy Lee Jones. Sounds like a good one.
Oh, Josh Brolin was terrific as a young Tommy Lee Jones. I just want to address the 3D comment because almost all of the big budget films this summer have been released in 3D, except for The Dark Knight Rises. And what has been impressing me, as opposed to years past, is I think the 3D technology has improved remarkably. And Stephanie says it wasn't as bad as she thought. I actually thought the 3D technology in Men in Black 3 was terrific, including this amazing jump off of a building scene with Will Smith. That's how he initiates time travel. And that blew me away. The 3D in Spider-Man, we didn't touch upon that, was absolutely remarkable. I actually saw it in IMAX 3D.
So it's getting better, you're
saying? It's getting significantly better.
Because the concern was it Hugo? Or was it another film before that we thought? Or maybe it was the remake of Titanic or something. I thought, wait a minute, are we overdoing this 3D stuff? Because people are grumbling about it, right? Not mm-hmm. everybody's that happy about it. Mm-hmm. But you're saying you think it's getting better.
I think it is. I wouldn't want to see every movie be made in 3D, and I think it'll never truly conquer the world till they get rid of the glasses, because that's a major, I think, I might be wrong, but yeah. I think it's a major impediment to its ultimate long-term success.
Right.
But at least what I'm seeing on the screen is improving.
Yeah, so I definitely agree.
You think it's getting better, Stephanie?
It definitely is.
Therefore, that would explain why you just said it wasn't as bad as I thought
it was. Yeah, I
was
really surprised when I first saw the movie.
Right, I think a lot of people feel that way. You can tell us what you think about 3D, too, if you want to give us a ring during this hour. I'm addressing our listeners now, 410-662-8780. So Will Smith, I mean, I don't know how Men in Black 3 has been doing. It opened at the end of May. I don't know how it compares to some of these others, but he always does so well at the box office, Will Smith. All right, where are we going next? What's the next one on our list? I lost my list here. Does anybody know?
I think it's To Rome with Love.
Yeah. Oh, okay. We'll hear from Galen on this one. Now, this is Woody Allen. Woody Allen's been sort of on this European tour with films, right? And Midnight in Paris, I read somewhere that was his best film in terms of box office, his most successful film or something like that.
That's believable. Yeah. It was a very charming film. I can't really say the same for To Rome with Love. Of the movies that I reviewed this summer, To Rome with Love got my worst grade. I give it a C, C+. C+ is probably generous. And if I were to rate it among other films made about Rome, I would give it an F.
Okay.
My immediate reaction was sort of, wow, this must have been produced by the Italian Ministry of Tourism. You know, they just, every scene is shot in front of some other famous tourist attraction. It seemed like the Ministry of Tourism just gave Woody Allen a sort of blank check and said, do what you will with the city, include Alitalia, include, you know, Fiat, and, you know, we will let you film a 2-second fashion show at the Arapaccis.
Was there a story at all? Can you discern it for us? Alec Baldwin shows up in this, right?
Alec Baldwin plays a very confusing role, and I found his role to be just annoying. He's sort of this sort of bird perched on Jesse Eisenberg's shoulder, sort of giving him advice on life and girls and celebrity. And so I guess if there was an overriding theme, it would probably be celebrity and sort of how celebrity corrupts, the attractiveness of celebrity, but also, you know, how the celebrated no longer want to be famous once they're there, and sort of the absurdity of it, especially living in a time when people can be famous for being famous. In fact, that's the case with Roberto Benigni's character. The two characters I was impressed with were Penelope Cruz. I thought she was excellent, although probably too beautiful to play a convincing Roman prostitute. And I would say I also enjoyed Fabio Armiliato. He's a tenor, and he plays a character who sings opera, but only in the shower. And the scenes
that's funny.
Yeah, the first scene of him singing opera in the shower, I was really impressed.
Well, does someone try to convince him to become a star, to go public?
Oh, and of course it's Woody Allen playing the sort of neurotic director.
Right, right.
And he ends up having a successful gig as an operatic tenor singing in the shower in the shows that he does.
Chris Reed, what about this one, To Rome with Love?
I enjoyed the film. I thought it was ultimately a little bit trivial, and I agree with a lot of Galen's criticisms, although I was a little kinder to the film. I haven't felt like Woody Allen actually is that important a director since the early 90s, and sort of I occasionally go to see his films, but they're usually, you know, they are what they are. Sometimes they're fun, sometimes they're not. I agree that Fabio Armiliato as the tenor singing Pagliacci in the shower was one of the highlights of the film.
I might see it just for that
yeah,
reason.
No, that's a great, and he's a real world-famous tenor,
yeah.
So his voice is really quite something, even while he's being drenched with water. And I think Penelope Cruz is almost worth the price of admission alone, kind of in her red dress.
And Judy Davis is in this, right? She plays Woody Allen's wife in the film?
She does play Woody Allen's wife. She's been in many Woody Allen films since the 90s, kind of one of his many muses over the years.
Some of these, I read one of the critics said that, made the same comment, similar comment that you made, Galen, about it being an advertisement for vacations in Rome, but also said there were a lot of sort of sight gags and jokes that were kind of old, hackneyed Woody Allen material. But anyway, let's listen to a little clip here. En route to see his daughter and his daughter's new fiance in Rome, Jerry, played by Woody Allen, and his wife Phyllis, played by Judy Davis, experience turbulence.
We may experience some turbulence. Please keep your seatbelts fastened and make sure all trays are in an upright position.
Great. Turbulence. My favorite.
No, you just relax and stop clenching your fists.
I can't unclench when there's turbulence. You know, I'm an atheist. I don't like this. It's bumping. The plane is bumping. I don't
wait
like
to
when
meet
it moves.
Her fiancé.
Like, you know, he's a communist.
It's not even the Communist Party here anymore. No, he's just very, very left.
Hey, listen, I was very left when I was his age, too, but I was never a communist. What? I couldn't share a bathroom.
Woody Allen. You know, I meant to do this before we got on the air today. How many films has Woody Allen made?
Oh, you're catching me off guard. But, I mean,
what's your guess? 50, 60?
No, probably more. He's done almost one a year for the past 30 years, so somewhere between 30 and 40 okay. is what I'd guess, but I could be wrong.
All right. 410-662-8780. This is Midday on Film with Christopher Llewellyn Reed from Stevenson University visiting us today and reviewing the summer movies along with our Midday interns, Galen Druk and Stephanie Hahn. We're going to take another break here. When we come back, we'll get some other films to talk about. Let's see. I'm going to go back to my list here. Oh, Moonrise Kingdom and Magic Mike coming up after this short break. I like this soundtrack. This is more Beasts of the Southern Wild. Is it almost always like this?
Yeah, this seems to be the general tenor of the film.
Yeah,
it's an excellent soundtrack.
Hey, we did some checking on Woody Allen. He's written 70 screenplays, directed 48 films, and has appeared in 44 films.
Wow.
And not all of them his, but most of them his, of those 44. We were just talking here about our favorite Woody Allen films. You have to go back a ways to find a favorite. I do anyway. Kind of drawing a blank on the last 10 years, although I really did like Midnight in Paris.
I thought Midnight in Paris was a superior film to Rome with Love. Not quite at the level of the ones I enjoyed in the past, such as Hannah and Her Sisters, or we were talking about Crimes and Misdemeanors, but I did really enjoy Midnight in Paris.
And I recommend, if you haven't seen it in a while, Broadway Danny Rose. That's from the late 80s with Mia Farrow, filmed in black and white. And it's just really funny, and I hadn't seen it in a long time and still enjoyed it. But you have to go back a ways, the late 80s, early 90s, I think. Midday on Film here, Christopher Llewellyn Reed joining us from Stevenson University, where he teaches film. He also is a filmmaker. And our Midday interns from Johns Hopkins, Galen Druk, who just graduated from Hopkins and spent the spring and summer with us as a Midday intern. We thank you for doing that. This is your last day with us, isn't it?
Yeah, it's been a pleasure.
And Stephanie Hahn has been here in the spring and summer, too, from Johns Hopkins, going to be a sophomore there this year. So we invited them to go out and spend some money and see these movies. And Chris, I want to also thank you for catching up on all your film watching in preparation for this show today. We'll go to Moonrise Kingdom next. There's a terrific cast here. Bill Murray, Frances McDormand, Bruce Willis, Tilda Swinton, Edward Norton, Jason Schwartzman. That looks pretty good to me. And the director is Wes Anderson. Who wants to start with this one? Galen, you want to tell us about this film? And then we'll hear from Chris on it. Go ahead.
Yes. Yeah. So the premise of the film is these two 12-year-olds from an island off the coast of New England who run away together. And it's sort of a misfit romance. Mm-hmm. You know, the boy doesn't really fit in with his scout troop, and you know, he even asks them at one point, you know, why don't you like me? And one of the scouts responds, well, why should I? Nobody else does. And same with this girl and her family. She has three brothers who are all, you know, exactly the same, but she doesn't fit in, and she has, you know, depression, which she found out by, you know, seeing her mother looking through a book about childhood depression. So they run off together, and it's sort of this inverted comedy where, you know, these two children have, you know, behave like adults while their parents behave childishly in their search to find them.
What's the era? Is the setting the 60s?
It's the 60s, yeah.
Okay. And in terms of the style of the film, Chris Reed, can you talk about that a little bit? Because I'm interested in Wes Anderson's films here.
I started out as a big Wes Anderson fan with this movie Rushmore, and then I discovered over time that he's become a little too twee for me. And I liken this latest exercise as if somebody took the shopping website Etsy.com with all these perfectly handcrafted, you know, really intricately made elements and turned it into a movie. That's what Moonrise Kingdom is. It's a labor of love. So much has been put into making every set feel as if somebody lovingly crafted, you know, the costumes, the sets. Hmm. It's a really unusual, unique story. And yet at some point it just became too much for me. And it's just a little too precious. So that's been my relationship to Wes Anderson since my initial kind of rhapsodic reaction to Rushmore's. With each subsequent film, I enjoy them less and less.
The Royal Tenenbaums?
That was part of my downward...
Down spiral? Fantastic Mr. Fox, of course, the animated film.
Very carefully crafted, enjoyed some parts of it. There's always something to enjoy in his films, but also I was not a huge fan of that film.
That's funny. I was taken with The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou.
I didn't see that. I did see Darjeeling Limited, which actually I liked more than I thought I would.
Did you see that one by any chance again?
I did not. I'm not in general a Wes Anderson enthusiast. So surprisingly, I did like this film, even though his style doesn't generally jive with me.
We're going to hear from the kids, I think, in this film clip that we have from Moonrise Kingdom. As you say, they run away together. They run away together for a second time, apparently.
Yes, right? They do.
Okay, so the young couple, Sam and Susie, played by Jared Gilman, Kara Hayward, enlist the help of this scoutmaster. This is Jason Schwartzman. Okay. They want to get married.
Yeah.
So the first voice you'll hear will be that of Jason Schwartzman.
You his girl?
Yes.
Technically, I'm a civil law scrivener. I'm authorized to declare births, deaths, and marriages. You're kind of young. You got a license. I can't offer you a legally binding union. It won't hold up in the state, the county, or frankly any courtroom in the world due to your age, lack of a license, and failure to get parental consent. But the ritual does carry a very important moral weight within yourselves. You can't enter into this lightly. Look into my eyes. Do you love each other?
Yes, we do.
But think about what I'm saying. Are you sure you're ready for this?
Yes, we are.
Okay, they're not listening to me. Let me rephrase it.
Oh, we're in a hurry.
Are you chewing? Spit out the gum, sister. In fact, everybody. I don't like the snappy attitude. This is the most important decision you've made in your lives. Go over by that trampoline and talk it through before you give me another quick answer.
Moonrise Kingdom. Comments from some of our listeners about other films we discussed, Beasts of the Southern Wild, here a little earlier. A comment from Harriet, who says she was fortunate to see the film at a special showing at MICA. It was a tour de force of storytelling and acting. The young actress is brilliant. This film is on her shoulders, and she carries it triumphantly. The film is a visceral experience. I have never seen a film like this, nor do I suspect I will again. It is in a class by itself. Bravo to all those who had a role in this film, Beasts of the Southern Wild. Anne commenting on the Disney Pixar film Brave, she says it's great to see an involved mother-daughter relationship and a happy ending, but as a mom with two young girls, I would have loved to see a more girl-powered heroine plot. What do you think of that, Stephanie?
I definitely agree. I mean, Pixar, it tried something new by giving it a female lead, but I think ultimately, even though she was so strong-willed, it kind of also gave this message that even if she tried to defy her mother, bad things would happen. So even if she tried to be independent and choose to fight for her own hand in marriage, bad things would eventually lead to her.
She needed her mom in the picture?
Yeah.
You mean to help make her decision?
Mm-hmm. She
has suitors, right? She has these guys after
She does,
her, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So does who makes the ultimate decision? Or maybe you don't want to spoil it for us.
Well, the film kind of ends up copping out a little bit and not quite it sort of ends before she's going to have to ultimately down the line grow up and make these decisions. I agree that it needed perhaps a little bit more girl power because she is a rebellious princess, but she does ultimately have to accept what it means to live in this world. So, you know, it's a worthy film. It's nice to see a female heroine in a Pixar film. It's nice to have mother-daughter relationship, but if you were looking for more, it's limited.
Okay. Yeah. There's another comment by email from Pauline regarding 3D. She says, I have to disagree with the 3D movies. As soon as I see that a movie will be in 3D, I skip it right away. I don't see the need for it. And my movie experience is not enhanced. I have to add another set of glasses to the ones I have to wear anyway. Give me a better screenplay if the studios want to enhance my movie experience.
And I think that's how a lot of people feel, which is why I say ultimately the future success of 3D will depend on them getting rid of the glasses.
Yeah.
I hear that.
You agree with that,
yeah.
Galen? I just want to make a comment about the Transformer films that I saw on the big screen. And those weren't in 3D, right?
I didn't see them. I only saw the first one. So
let me. I had a really bad experience trying to follow the transformation of these, robots, and the action in the film was to me so digitally crazy. My eye couldn't follow it. I had a hard time adjusting it. Now maybe it's because of my age. I don't know what, but it just seemed everything was happening. It's hard to explain it. Everything seemed to be pulling apart on the screen for me, and I could not follow the forms. And I understand that in the Transformers, they actually transform from one thing to another, so that's supposed to happen. But I wanted to be able to follow it, but I couldn't. There was just too many little pieces on the screen, for too many pixels for me, I guess.
How close do you sit to the front of the theater?
I don't. I sit a good ways back. Chris,
I was just going to say, I think that's a wonderful example, that entire series of technology overwhelming the story. And I think, you know, all of these tools are but tools to tell a story. And if they become the raison d'etre of the film, then it's not going to be a good experience. Going back to your comment about animation and Pixar, it's really always going to be about story. And, you know, what I'm just finding is that for the first time this summer, I'm seeing films where they're actually using 3D to advance the story in interesting ways, and that's what's surprising and impressing me.
Okay, so we'll give Paulina there a note from Chris Reed that maybe you ought to just try it one more time. It is getting better.
Or wait until they get rid of the glasses.
Wait until they get rid of the glasses. Okay, can we talk about Ted? This one looks pretty good. It stars one of my favorite actors, Mark Wahlberg. This is Seth MacFarlane directing and voicing
and writing.
This teddy bear, right?
It's basically his baby, this movie.
Is this a good movie? This looks... I've only seen the trailer. No? Okay, let's hear from you. Well, who wants to start? Stephanie?
Okay, right. First, parents should not bring their kids to this movie. It's not a family-friendly movie. If people are familiar with Seth MacFarlane's work on Family Guy and his other animations, they should know he's... He gives a raunchier take on cartoons, and I think it's a more adult version of child-like stories.
Mm-hmm.
And I enjoyed it, but there definitely is a lot of profanity.
Well, I'm glad you're saying that, because if you watch the trailer, you definitely get the impression that this is a family film. No, Chris,
no, you don't. You definitely don't.
Well, this is not a family movie.
Okay. I get that from Seth MacFarlane, but a lot of people might not pick up on it. If you just went by the trailer, you might say, hey, that looks like a funny movie about a teddy bear that talks to a guy.
Of course, it's also R-rated, so that would hopefully give people...
I don't know today if people pay attention to this
stuff. I think what's surprising about it is you expect it to be completely inappropriate, but the storyline he builds between John, the main character who's played by Mark Wahlberg, and Ted, the teddy bear, it's kind of heartfelt, so it's the redeeming factor, I think, in the movie.
Chris?
I couldn't stand this movie. For the first 10 minutes, I was on board, and then it lost me and never got me back. I think in films, it's very hard sometimes to figure out ways to kind of externalize internal conflicts in ways that are meaningful and visual. And so in that sense, the premise of this movie is brilliant, right? You have an aging adolescent male, and he's got a teddy bear who walks and talks. That's really smart. But the fact that he has this teddy bear smoking pot, doing all sorts of other bad things, with a potty mouth, it seemed like it was a one-joke movie that never got past that one joke. For me. Now, the film's number 4 at the box office, so I'm clearly in the minority. But I did not enjoy the movie.
We have a clip from it. After being forced by John, played by Mark Wahlberg, to get a job. He actually forces the teddy bear to get a job. Ted... gets employed at a supermarket and meets a girl.
Mm-hmm.
Is this all correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, not a girl teddy bear, but a girl.
No, an actual girl.
An actual girl. And in this scene, John is trying to guess the name of Ted's new girlfriend.
Yeah.
Okay. And Seth MacFarlane's. It's his voice that you'll hear first.
I met a girl. She's a cashier.
No way. That's awesome. Yeah. Oh, you know what's her name?
White trash name. Guess.
Mandy.
Nope.
Marilyn.
Nope.
Brittany?
Nope.
Tiffany?
Nope.
Candace? All right, speed round. I'm going to rattle off some names, and when I hit it, buzz it, okay?
I will tell you.
You got me?
Yeah.
All right, Brandy, Heather, Channing, Brianna, Amber, Sabrina, Melody, Dakota, Sierra, Bambi, Crystal, Samantha, Autumn, Ruby, Taylor, Tara, Tammy, Lauren, Charlene, Chantel, Courtney, Misty, Jenny, Krista, Mindy, Noelle, Shelby, Trina, Reba, Cassandra, Nikki, Kelsey, Shauna, Jolene, Erling, Claudine, Savannah, Casey, Dolly, Kendra, Kylie, Chloe, Devin, Emily, Becky?
Nope.
Wait, was it any one of those names with a Lynn after it?
Yes.
I got you. Okay. Brandy Lynn, Heather Lynn,
Tammy Lynn.
Ah!
Okay, but you think it's one joke, Chris.
Well, I thought that scene was actually very funny.
That sounds clever, yeah.
My problem is that it belongs to a genre of films, as I classify them, that seem to act as if the very fact that somebody's uttering a profanity is a joke unto itself.
Yeah.
And at some point, for me, that just becomes tiresome. And I wish the humor resided elsewhere in writing such as what we just heard, but that, for me, was the minority of the
scene. So who's this film for? This is for
fans of Family
teenage
Guy.
Boys, fans of Family Guy? Okay. But even more profane than Family Guy. Gotta be.
It definitely is.
Yes,
it's like a live-action Family Guy.
Okay, and then we get to Magic Mike. We want to end the show with Magic Mike about male strippers, right? And Matthew McConaughey is in this. Galen, did you see it?
I did see it. Huh? I enjoyed it.
Yeah?
Yeah, I would. It's a very fun film. And, you know, it's definitely new. You know, you don't really see the male body used in this way in cinema. Really, maybe at all, and especially not in a box office hit like this.
Well, let's listen to a clip, and we'll come back and hear from Chris and Stephanie on this. Just a few seconds here of from the movie where Matthew McConaughey, he owns the strip club, right? Okay, and he's teaching this new recruit played by Channing Tatum a few of his moves.
You're not just stripping. Are you all fulfilling every woman's wildest fantasies? You are the husband that they never had. You are that dreamboat guy that never came along. You are the one-night stand, that free fling of a that they get to have tonight with you on stage and still go home to their hubby and not get in trouble because you, baby, you made it legal. You are the liberation. Own it.
Okay.
I have to say, Matthew McConaughey is fantastic in this movie. I'm glad to see him no longer starring in insipid romantic comedies and actually taking some chances with movies. He was great, and I really enjoyed the film. And I thought Channing Tatum, whom I've never taken seriously as an actor, was quite good. Some pretty good dance moves, too.
Really? Impressive.
Yeah, and Cody Horn, who plays the lead female, who happens to be the daughter of the CEO of Disney, is also quite good.
Stephanie Hom, what did you think of this?
Yeah, I thought it was great. I mean, lots of gratifying shots. It's like it's actually like going to a strip club, kind of, except it's in the movie. Like, the cinematography, like, it really brings you up close to the stage, and
really?
You see all the actors dancing topless. And
topless?
Yeah.
Well, more than topless.
Oh, okay.
Well,
all right, Stephanie, thank you very much for your reviews today. Stephanie Hama, thank you for interning with us this summer here at Midday. And Galen Druk, we're going to miss you. Thank you for your contributions to the show, and good luck to you.
Thank you.
Galen Druk, who graduated from Hopkins, served here as a Midday intern. And his first time doing reviews with us on summer movies, Christopher Llewellyn Reed. Thank you for being here, Chris.
Thank you, Dan.
Chris
enjoyed it.
And teaches at Stevenson University and is a filmmaker himself.
The executive producer of Midday is Vanessa Eskridge. The producers are Nikki Gamer and Michael Himowitz. Our interns are Galen Druk, Stephanie Hom, Olivia McClary, Ella Mickle-Tyler, and Julian Tolliver. Our director and engineer is Tom Welch. Our music is produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Podcasts of Midday are available at WIPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears each Tuesday, Thursday, and Sunday in the Baltimore Sun. This is WIPR, your NPR news station.